Welcome back to another episode of Dose of Pharma. So, Sarah, who do we have on for this week's episode?
Hey, Christine. So today we're talking to Belinda Carley, the founder of the Institute of Personal Care Science. She has an extensive background in the cosmetic industry, from being a naturopath to then working in regulatory affairs and then moving on to product development from there. And now she's offering courses at the Institute of Personal Care Science. And we talk all things cosmetics, from what it takes to take an idea to the market. And we also go into the roles involved throughout the whole process. So, Christine, what does cosmetics mean to you?
Well, I guess it's quite interesting going into this course. I didn't realize that cosmetics was something that I guess we could walk out going into. But I think growing up, I was always in the bathroom mixing up things. My parents always tell me that I was mixing up shampoos. Or I guess a story that I'll never forget is I was playing around with nail polish and I accidentally spilled it on my parents' bed, and that stain is still there. So I guess knowing as well through primary school and high school, different projects, somehow makeup was always involved. So yeah, to I guess know that now cosmetics is something that we can go into after we finish, it's really interesting. And as well hearing Belinda elaborate on that as well. How about for you?
Yeah, I had like a somewhat similar experience, except the reason I went into our pharmacy course was I was interested in producing cosmetics. And with the little research I did, I found that formulation was a big factor and that this was one of the courses that offered formulation specifically. But from the chat we had with Belinda, and you guys will get to see soon, I didn't realize how much was involved in producing a product. And from, you know, you have to formulate the ingredients, let alone the product, to then realizing, you know, what is on trend and how to identify a trend. And these are all things that we get to discuss today. And I just wish I had this kind of resource when I was younger. So yeah, let's hop right into it. Welcome, Belinda. Thanks for sparing some time to speak to us today. How are you going?
Good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, we're pretty good, thanks. I'm Sarah and this is Christine. And yeah, we'd just love for you to tell us a little bit about yourself, your background and how you got to where you are now, please.
Sure. Well, goodness me, a long time ago, I started as a naturopath. I did my Bachelor of Natural Therapies through Southern Cross University, and I was working as a naturopath for a while, very much into herbal extracts, homeopathy, and then I wanted to work more in research and development. So I was actually working in research and development of ingestible products, and as part of that role, and regulatory affairs, I was doing a lot in regulatory affairs. Part of that role actually led me into the research and development of topical products for cosmetics. So I did a lot of TGA therapeutic goods at the time, a lot of ingestible products, supplements, herbals in supplements. And then I started to work more and more with cosmetics. From there, I worked with a company for a few years in that R&D role. And then, well, it started as regulatory, it turned into R&D. From there, I became a consultant. When I was consulting, I was still formulating for people, doing regulatory affairs. And again, it covered your ingestible supplements, your herbal extracts and topical products. And then I had a couple of clients actually want me to teach them how to formulate, how to make product. And that led to me developing the Institute, because there just wasn't the professional level of training around for cosmetic science that was easily accessible in Australia and that met Australian government or tertiary requirements. So I worked for a few years developing the actual courses. I got them peer reviewed by others in the industry, the Australian Society of Cosmetic Chemists. They peer reviewed all of the learning and assessment materials. I had to get them all through ASQA, the government accreditation. So all of our courses, originally had just the one diploma, but we are a registered training organisation. We had to get that accreditation through the Australian Skills Quality Authority, which is who oversees your TAFE and private training organisations like us. That took 2 years. And then we finally launched the Institute. That was all the way back in 2005, I believe, 2007. about then, a long time ago. And then since then, we've been delivering the training. We now train in over 70 different countries around the world. Several thousand students have been through our courses. And of course, we've developed other advanced certificate and diploma courses to complement our big diploma of personal care formulation. That's it in a nutshell.
Wow, it's such a diverse and like holistic background within the industry. So like given all of that experience, how do you think like the Australian cosmetic industry has like changed from when you started out from being a naturopath to where you are now?
Well, it's interesting because one of the things that first attracted me to working with cosmetics was the ridiculousness of how cosmetic ingredients are going to kill you, which by the way is not true. But what got me interested in that is I've always been very science and factually based. So even when I was working as a naturopath, I used to work with doctors because I believe there's the best to be had from both traditional and modern approaches. So that kind of got me into personal care, and I really wanted to look at the ingredients. So when I was developing products for the company I was working for, they had a lot of emphasis on avoiding these so-called nasty ingredients. And then when I did a lot of research, I of course found that there is nothing wrong with these ingredients when you use them properly, the way you should be. And of course I was in regulatory affairs as well, so you know I worked with all the evidence and the claims support, so I was always coming up from a very scientific factual approach. And of course, I had all my proper herbal medicine training, not just internet herbal medicine research. It was proper degree herbal medicine training, and that in that we actually did a whole pharmaceutical science course. Like we had to understand pharmacognosy, just like you guys would learn. So there was that background that I had that I kind of brought into this cosmetics industry where they talk so much about how ingredients are going to kill you. And unfortunately, with the internet, it's gone out of control. We see in Australia in particular, they are very advanced with natural ingredients and using natural ingredients and using the benefits of natural ingredients. So while it's not true that natural is necessarily safer, and while it's definitely not true that synthetic chemicals will kill you, there is actually benefits to be had from using natural alternatives in your formula. And of course, that's grown over time. And now we're very much interested in sustainability. Sustainability in all sectors, but definitely in our industry, is a very important thing. And of course, natural ingredients do tend to have better sustainability. So it fits in with the way the market has been moving and had more and more interest in natural ingredients, mainly because people do think natural is instantly safe, which isn't necessarily correct. But because it's always been moving that way, the sustainability message ties in really nicely with consumers' interest in natural ingredients. And of course, a lot of our personal care today now contains a lot of herbal extracts and vitamins and things. So the industry's been moving that way, and luckily I had that background to move with it. Sorry, did that answer the original question?
Oh, yeah, definitely did. Sorry. Yeah, so you kind of mainly at the Institute just work more with sustainable formulations and really push for your students and people to learn based off that?
No, we teach everything. We teach very much all of it. One of the things because we have people say to us, a lot of people are interested in natural and sustainable. The way we explain it to them is, no, we're not going to teach you just that, because there's so much to be said for the performance, stability enhancing benefits of a lot of synthetic ingredients. They've been created for a reason. Let's face it, they make a formulator's job a lot easier in many cases. That's not to say that there aren't some great natural ingredients too. In fact, there's heaps of great natural actives out there, and more because of the interest in that area. But we teach both natural and synthetic. And the other thing we say to people is, if you're trying to create a really natural product, but you don't understand how a synthetic ingredient works, how can you possibly try and mimic that performance or stability aspect if you don't understand how that ingredient works in the first place? So we teach both, and definitely in assessments, students can then focus on what they're more interested in. But we definitely teach a very comprehensive approach of natural and synthetic, because you can't call yourself a cosmetic chemist if you don't understand all the ingredients that you are either trying to use or trying to mimic.
Yeah, definitely. So like given that, would you be able to take us through how you go from a concept of a product to then bringing it to the market, regardless of whether it's more natural or synthetic, and what like this looks like and how it can be implemented.
Now, I'm not sure what sort of timelines you guys work with in your program, but we try and make sure people do not expect to go from concept to launch in under, for a professional product, under 9 months is just forget about it. You're being silly. And that's because you do have to go through the quality and stability measures as you go. Let's say you came to me today and you said, Belinda, I want to make this really nice, you know, anti-aging serum, for example. Well, the first thing I need to know is, well, what would you like in it? What would you like to avoid? Because that, again, it's still important for a lot of companies. What target market, what age group are we really going for? How do you want it to feel? As I've mentioned, sensory is a really strong and very important aspect of the formulas that we create. So as a cosmetic chemist, we're not just creating a product to be stable or to deliver an active, it's also got to be sensorily pleasing to that target market, that consumer. And of course, it has to resonate with what they're looking for. There's so much competition and all these different products promising to do all these things. So the marketing is actually the first step, and then the product has to deliver on the promises. So you might come to me with this brief, we call it a brief, and it would tell me those things, and then I would need to source the materials specific to your project. So then I would contact my suppliers, and you know, different suppliers have different materials, and of course formulas are multi-component substances. So, you know, I might have 12 ingredients in there. I might have to go to 6 different suppliers for all my different ingredients. Then I wait, you know, and I could be waiting a good 3 or 4 weeks just for materials to arrive. When all of the materials come in, I can't make a sample until I have all of those materials. So that would quite typically be 3 or 4 weeks just there. Then I can start making samples in the lab. And it's not just the first sample that we would send. Like, for instance, you know, I wouldn't send you the very first sample I make. I would put together my formula. I've got my raw materials now. I'd put together my first sample. I'd feel it myself. No, Sarah's not going to be happy with this. So I'd redo it. And then I'd try it again. Nearly, you know, redo it again. You know, and we're talking, you know, there's a day or so between each of these, because I've got to wait till the next day. I've got to evaluate it the next day. And then I might go, yeah, I think Sarah might like this. So then I'd send it to you. You give it a go, you try it out. You might want to even try it. If it's an anti-aging product, you might need to trial it for, say, not you, obviously, you don't need it. Your mum might want to try it for 14 days, 28 days to see if it's actually working. And then you'd give me the feedback. And your initial feedback would definitely be on the sensory parameters, like, oh, it smells a bit strong, or doesn't the aroma's not strong enough, or it doesn't feel like it absorbs fast enough, or it feels a little tacky on the skin. These are all important bits of feedback that I then go, okay, I know what I need to adjust. Then I can go back to the lab, make another couple of samples, just playing with those, with the ingredients I know that are going to manipulate those variables that you want changed. So in that, again, there's like another week or so of sampling, send it over to you again, get your feedback again. Usually we would repeat that process probably 3 times. So again, there's another good month or more going backwards and forwards with the samples, because remember, it's not just what I like, it's not just what you like, it's what your target market wants. And again, this is where it's different between what a cosmetic chemist does to what you guys would do. You know, you're really focused on that delivery and stabilizing the actives. We obviously want to stabilize our actives, but they're quite different. They're not the pharmaceutical result that you're looking for. And sensory is so important in our industry. So we've really got to play with those things that's going to suit your target market, especially knowing that there's so much other choice for that consumer out there. So yeah, we do this. So we would probably get sign off on the samples that you're happy with about 3 months. That's quite normal. Less than 8 weeks would be not typical. So somewhere between 8 and 12 weeks to get to a point where we've got a formula and a sample that you're really happy with. And then the next stage starts. So that's when we would start. If you're dealing with a contract manufacturer, they would then be able to prepare large lab samples. And we would also start preliminary stability on the large lab samples. Now, in our industry, we could go to market. It's a bit of a risk, but we could go to market from when we have 3 months accelerated stability. And again, that's probably quite different to a pharmaceutical product, but we would have ongoing accelerated stability. So basically we'd need to wait 3 months before we order the really large quantities of materials for the full batch, or even what we would call a pilot batch. And I guess that you guys would do the same. So we go large lab batch, pilot batch, full batch. So at the 3 months accelerated results, if we're happy with them, we would then order what we need for the pilot. We'd make the pilot. Usually it's going to take about 3 months to come in. By then we've got 6 months accelerated stability. We'd make the full batch. We go to market and we watch the stability as we go. So I'm not sure exactly how similar that is to your timelines, but don't forget that's 6 months there plus our 3 months initially, which is why I say 9 months. Now, can I just put a big warning into everyone there? Things never go to plan. There's always a delay. There's always a hiccup. You know, it could be the packaging arrives late. Well, you're not going to make product if you haven't got packaging to fill it into. There could be, you know, we're seeing huge delays on raw materials because of COVID. What would normally be, don't forget, some of these raw materials take 3 months to arrive, but now we're seeing some of them take 6 months. So it's blowing that line out. This is logistical issues. There's nothing you can do about it. It's quite normal for a raw material to take 8 to 12 weeks to arrive normally, but now we're seeing that extend. So in a nutshell, that's how we do it. So it is, like I say, 9 months if everything goes well, and I don't think I've ever seen everything just go perfectly to plan. I have a video actually where I go through that, and I've sent you those links, so you might want to share that with your viewers later. You know, you actually see me mocking up, you know, sample after sample after sample in the lab. And that's when you've got an experienced chemist. When someone's first graduated, for example, they could expect to make between 6 to 20 variants before they're happy with it. Even with an experienced chemist like myself, I would still probably be doing at least 3 variants at the start. And by the time we finished a project, we're probably up to variant 8 or 10. You know, again, it's about, it's not what I like, it's not what you like, it's what the target market wants and what's going to be competitive in the marketplace. So it's a very competitive environment too.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You mentioned, I guess, the sensory part of cosmetics is really important. And I guess from a consumer side, that's also something that I definitely agree with. When like comparing products on the market, such as like cheap versus expensive, and I guess you tend to notice that difference in sensory experience. Is that because, I guess, the quality of the ingredients or the amount of ingredients or the type of ingredients?
It's usually partly the type of ingredients and usually the time in the R&D. So part of that R&D time, so you know how I said I could easily take 3 to 10 variants, a less experienced chemist would be 6 to 20. Well, when you're talking about a really high-end, more expensive product, you could almost double that because it has to feel, and you know, you would know just from touching and feeling some of these products, multiple variants get made with multiple variations of the emulsifiers or the lipids that get used. They don't just accept the first sample. They go, hey, give me 3 different versions that meet this brief. Because again, it's about what is going to suit that target market, especially considering everything else that's out there. So more R&D definitely. And this is, a good time to talk maybe about sunscreens, because this is a definitely big crossover for our industries. Big regulatory challenge, full stop. I'm not sure how much you've looked at that with sunscreens. There's extra stability requirements. There's obviously the full SPF testing. So there's a lot of extra development. So, you know, I said to you, if everything goes well, a good development takes 9 months. Well, with a sunscreen, if everything goes well, you're looking more like 15 months. Minimum. You know, you've got to have more stability behind you. You've got to have those assays. You know, it's a lot more work. There's also limits on different ingredients. So you've also got to cross check with the eBiz site. I'm not sure if you guys learned that. So everything you use in a sunscreen when it's under TGA has to be a listable ingredient. So you can't just use whatever emulsifier or oil you want to use, or preservative even. And even the preservative you pick, you have to use within a limit. And your sunscreen agents have to be used within a limit. So when you get those, let's say $50 sunscreens, what I would like to say is the proof is in the product. Is it performing better? No, it's performing to its SPF claim because you've got to hold that evidence for TGA. But you feel the difference. Go and have a swim and the cheaper one runs in your eyes and it stings and you're crying. The high-end one that costs more, a lot more R&D You know, you're talking three times the work in R&D to make it feel absolutely beautiful. Sunscreen agents, if you ever work with them, feel tacky. If it's zinc oxide, it's chalky. These materials that we're using feel horrible. We've got to make them feel good, and then we've got to stabilize them really homogeneously for a very prolonged shelf life. So they've got a lot more R&D in them. And then you've got to make them feel good, like to a $50 standard. So, you know, it's definitely, I mean, that's a more extreme example, but that is the one of the differences between your $20 face cream and your $100 face cream. Definitely the ingredients too, the actives, there's usually quite a significant difference in the actives and the amount of the active that gets used. So yes, they generally do have a higher performance. Caution to the ladies watching this, don't spend over $100, okay? Beyond that, it just becomes marketing hype. You heard it from the cosmetic chemist.
Yeah, so I guess with the SPF, like there's clear guidelines on the testing and what's required. I guess from like more of a like pharmaceuticals perspective, when we're testing like a pharmaceutical product, the clinical trial like pipeline, which has become quite topical due to COVID, it's very clear and outlined for like sensory and like feeling and like application and efficacy in like a cosmetic sense. How do you like companies give you that feedback, or you receive that feedback or test for these things in a way that's measurable and not necessarily biased depending on the person you're testing on?
That is a very good question. We do use a lot more market evaluations, which is much more subjective. So again, it's really about, you get a pool of that target market and you get them to use the product and you ask them those things, you get ratings from them. I'm sorry to disappoint you and your viewers. Some of those metrics, they don't have very scientific backing other than we sent this product to a group of 30-year-old women and 25 of them said, yes, they loved the way it felt. So, you know, is there a measurable way in terms of sensory? No. A lipstick, we can definitely measure gloss, but skin feel preference, it is over to consumers, and we do try and pick from the target market, or the brand making the product would pick from the target market as much as possible to get that result. It's not going to be scientifically measurable. We can definitely feel tack. You can measure tack. You can see that with a product, you know, if you do that and you can see it stringing. But in terms of sensory, these are consumer preferences.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, if like say it's a new brand, like they'll evolve as they release more products and like understand what works for their target market, and it's kind of like more niche rather than...
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So we've gone through like the concept to the release and gone through like the testing and everything. Within that, what are like the roles involved? And because we get like a bit of an explanation of them, but there's so much more out there that we can learn about.
Yeah, there is. We've just done a video on careers in the cosmetics industry that our training supports. And if you have a look on our website, you can provide them with a link to our jobs page. We actually post jobs. One of the things I would say for the viewers is that if they had your degree and our diploma of personal care formulation, they would be at the top of the employer's selection. One or the other, you're probably still going to get an interview. Having both would really benefit you if you're serious about a career in our industry. Look, there's so many. Where do we start? Okay, there's obviously the cosmetic chemist. Being a cosmetic chemist for a brand is obviously the most obvious role we've just talked about there. There's a lot of assistant roles as well. So you would often find that you get an entry level into an assistant position where you're working with a more experienced chemist in a bigger company. That's a great position if you snag one of them, because you've usually got someone you can learn from, lean on. There's a lot of other jobs too. So with raw material suppliers, if you don't mind a bit of travel over in Singapore, not right now, but over in Singapore, there is a lot of opportunity. Singapore is actually a big hub for raw material manufacturers. And a lot of them, what they do is they actually research materials, again, natural. This is where the natural and sustainable comes in. So there's two sort of arms. They can look at your functional ingredients, like your emulsifiers and things like that. Or they could look at their actives, a lot of them, herbal extracts, for example, also peptides maybe. So as an R&D chemist, with a supplier in their lab at the start, they would actually investigate these different materials, and you would do a lot of R&D work, say getting a synthetic emulsifier and a sustainable natural option and comparing them. And that would be, they definitely do measure things like your sensory, your stability. So you do development at that end. With actives and extracts, this is actually exciting if you do get one of these jobs. Not a lot of them, but again, you'd want to be overseas. There's not many in Australia, where they actually research an extract. For example, let's say they picked a rose that grows, you know, on the highest mountain, and somehow it still comes out every spring and it survives this harsh, cruel weather. What is in there that enables it to survive this really bad weather and yet grow each year? And what could this do for skin cells? And they've actually found actives where they've got, like, you know, alpine rose, and they've taken the stem cells from the alpine rose, and then it does have this regenerative effect on the skin. So you can work with a raw material supplier at the actual R&D stage of proving or disproving that something will have a functionality or performance. And then, of course, you've got to do a lot of studies, and they start in vitro and they do a lot of skin cell tests and see what is it doing there. And then, of course, they've still got to ensure safety and things like that. And then it moves to human trials, and then they look at performance results. What does it do in terms of what you see? So that's a great role if you can get one of them. There's actually a lot of jobs in Australia, either with contract manufacturers as a cosmetic chemist or in an R&D role where you're working with clients. They send in a brief and you start developing the formula, get their approval, and then go to manufacture. There's jobs with manufacturers in scale-up. So you guys would definitely do some of that, I imagine, where you actually look at the production process from lab and you've got to validate the process so that it's going to work from lab stage to pilot stage to full-scale manufacture. And if something goes wrong, you need to fix it fast, try and save the batch. There's a lot of those roles in Australia. Within privately owned companies, even smaller companies, a lot of them either would use a cosmetic chemist as a consultant, or people have their own brand a lot too. Then there's another very big opportunity with raw material suppliers. So raw material suppliers here in Australia. So for instance, me as a chemist, I would normally meet regularly with my suppliers. My suppliers would come to me representing various raw materials. They'll tell me about the latest innovations. I will sit there and think, how is this solving a formulation issue, or how is it improving sensory, or this is a new active. So those raw material positions are in the sales position. Now, they definitely require either a degree or our diploma, because when they're meeting with the chemist, they want that salesperson to be able to talk the language and understand how the materials work to sell them. You can't sell them to a chemist if you don't understand what the materials are doing. So they definitely look for either of our qualifications, or again, like I say, both. Even a contract manufacturer, if you had both, you're at the top of the list. Also within those suppliers, there would often be a technical person. And a technical person is back at their office answering all the questions that the formulator has. Like, I've tried using your material, but I didn't get the results. You know, what have I done wrong? Or here's my formula and I'm having this issue. How can I solve it? A technical person with a raw material supplier would often also use combinations of the materials that supplier has to provide prototypes or example formulas to give chemists and companies ideas that they will then adapt to suit their particular brief or philosophies. So there's loads of those jobs in Australia, and loads of the contract manufacturing jobs, the R&D within those. And of course, then there's still quality testing. Someone's got to do the quality testing. So micro testing, stability is definitely a big opportunity, because no one wants to face a product recall. There's so many opportunities. And then of course, like I said, there's entry level roles for each of these positions as well.
Wow, that's so cool. I definitely didn't know, I guess, all that like raw material side of things. I didn't like realize how many job opportunities there were, which is really cool. And I guess that story about the alpine rose, like, that is so cool to be able to go into a job like that.
You know, another thing they actually do too is they will sometimes even get those materials, or they'll get an existing material, and especially now they're looking at ways to better develop it so it's more sustainable. So there's loads of those jobs emerging. Again, those types of really back at the start type roles tend to be overseas. Singapore is definitely a hub for those kind of companies, but you'll find them in other countries as well. Australia, we do have a few, You know, there's definitely not none in Australia. There's definitely some more with Australian natural extracts and things. But Singapore, if you don't mind the travel, you definitely get one there when we can travel again.
Yeah. We're kind of like going through all of those. You've mentioned like the need for not only awareness of like the science and the products, but like some commercial awareness, the ability to collaborate with others. Beyond that, what do you believe like our graduates, like from our course and your courses, need to set themselves apart? Because I'm currently doing some placement experience and I'm heading towards the end of my degree, and basically at every step I've been told these are quite competitive. So what would you recommend for students to develop themselves in order to like be ready for these roles?
Okay, so if you're really serious about getting a job as a cosmetic chemist, either with a company, contract manufacturer, raw material supplier, the best advice I can give you, same advice I give our students, is make some product. So you can go to small suppliers like New Directions, for example. You are a little limited in the materials you can get, but the best thing you can do is rock up at an interview with three different types of products, three different forms, three different sensories about them, the formulas, to show them you can do the job. There's nothing more frustrating than having someone arrive to an interview, for example, or even when you're doing the pre-interview stage, and they might have this fancy resume with loads of letters after their name, but you go, okay, show me, put a formula together showing me a face cream. And like they quite literally just hand you the most boring, basic excuse for a face cream. There's nothing special about it, and it's, you know, they write it patchy, you know, patchy down notes. No, not hiring that person. I don't care how many letters you've got after your name. I want to see that you actually can do it. One analogy I give people, it's a basic analogy, but it really drives it home. You go to a hairdresser, how much difference do you notice between different hairdressers? And yet apparently they've all been trained the same. So if you want that role as a cosmetic chemist with a company, show them you can do it. Don't just rock up thinking, hey, I'm young, I'm ambitious. Look, and I love that. I think a lot of companies are looking for that because we are a rapidly innovative industry, and they want that freshness of face and freshness of ideas, but they also want to know that you can do the job. So if you rock up with samples and formulas in the proper format, you know, with your phases, with your trade names, don't just use common names, show the trade names, with the method written properly, and you've got your sample there to show different forms, different sensory aspects, that is what will get you the job. And of course, the qualifications, obviously, but show them, because, you know, even when we have positions going here for trainers and development chemists here, I get resumes with, you know, the most impressive titles, and I ask for a demonstration, like I ask for, you know, a sample or an example of what they've done. I can tell you 9 out of 10 of them fumble and falter, and you know why? Because they're not ready for that. They're ready to use their title to get them in the door. Honestly, my best advice, show that you can do it.
Yeah, like actions are speaking louder than words.
Absolutely. And they'll be so impressed that you took the initiative. And it's fun, you know, making product is a lot of fun. So, and it gets you ready as well, because if you start making samples, you make your formula. And it's one thing to have a really good theoretical formula. It's another thing to have a beautiful finished product. So if you work through the process yourself at home, like I say, you can go to the New Directions website, you can get materials from them, get playing, get making, get comfortable with it. And then you'll see for yourself what I'm talking about when I say, you know, there's a big difference. There is a big difference between a cosmetic chemist or cosmetic formulator that is confident in the lab, that knows their stuff, that understands the basics, but is not afraid to then keep working at it, sample after sample, to get it just right. And that doesn't just serve you to get the job, but it also helps later when you want that career advancement, you know, to make it better and better and be prepared to work on something several times until it is really competitive and the next best thing.
Yeah, that's so cool. I guess I never thought, even though, as Sarah said, we are both of us at the end of our degree, we're still yet to, I guess, get to that job searching stage. But yeah, whenever we learn about tips and tricks for interviews, I think that's something that we never really learn. And I think, as you said, if you do come with something ready, and actually show that you can do it, I feel like that really does make you stand out from the crowd.
So yeah, and don't be afraid even to send it in. Or even like if you're emailing in your resume and information, send in the examples, show them straight away, because what you're really doing is you're showcasing your ability to do it, and that will definitely get you to the top of the list. The initiative of the time, because you don't want to hand them in a dodgy formula, do you? You don't want to go in with substandard products. So if they see that you've taken that initiative, that is really impressive to any employer.
Yeah. So let's say with, I guess, current students, in some of our units, we formulate like creams or tablets. And I guess given that we learn at a very basic level, so that we, I guess, understand all the different elements, would something, I guess, one of our projects that we've worked on, providing a formula we've used for that, even though it's very basic level, would that be, I guess, enough?
If you want to stand out against the competitors, no, yeah. If I'm being honest. Okay. You really want to show them that you can do more than just the basics. Again, it depends a bit on the role you're going for. If you're entering at a lab assistant or an R&D assistant, yes, fine. Definitely if you show them that you can make the sample. Do you know, I went for a job years and years and years ago. This is before I had the institute. And I remember I rocked up at the interview and they asked me 5 times, can you actually put product together at a bench? And I said to them, of course I can. Like, yes. And then they asked me, by the 5th time, I said, where's your lab? Let me show you. I guess I got frustrated by the question, but I was young. I was very young. How old was I? God, that would be a long time ago. I was probably early 20s. And so that's why I give that same advice to people now, because you are up against a lot of people. If you are young, especially, show them. There's nothing like showing to get you that interview. And of course you go, they know you're going to be nervous. They're more interested in what you can do. And you've already shown them, you've already got that foot in the door.
Yeah. And definitely, like, if our viewers are interested in trying out some formulations, speaking from experience, I've looked at your videos for one of my projects, making a micellar water, and your videos were quite helpful and easy to understand.
No, thank you. And the formulas, the way we set them out, that is exactly what they want to see. That's how we set them out in the industry. I mean, my template's a little bit plainer because, you know, obviously it's going to suit a really wide audience, but the important elements are there. You know, you've got your weight for weight. We do everything in weight. You've got all your phases. You've got your method set out. We talk high and low shear. We talk temperatures where it's important. Another thing they don't want to see, they don't want to see you just write a lab method, okay, which you guys have probably done a lot of. When you have a look at the formula examples I provide with my videos, you'll see they're actually more generically written. So I won't say add to a 200 ml beaker. I will say, you know, combine phase A and heat to 75 degrees. Combine phase B, heat to 75 degrees, stir under low shear. I'm not giving an RPM. The reason I'm not is because you can't. When you scale up, whatever your method is here for the lab, fine. If you're validating it for a lab purpose, or when you get to production stage and you're validating it for production side, the size, definitely write your vessel, definitely write your RPM and your time. But when you're writing a method, it has to be more general so that anyone who picks it up can then adapt it to small or large. So if I say high shear, you should be going homogenizer. You know, if I say low shear, you're going propeller, you know. And of course, we're saying until homogenous is an endpoint. I'm not saying do it for 5 minutes, because how do I know how big your batch is? 5 minutes could be way too long, it could be way too short. But if I'm saying, you know, until it's homogenous or until a glossy emulsion forms, I'm giving you an endpoint. Now, definitely when you get to production, you write the specific method. And there's another job in itself. That person's job to take it from the general to make it specific, to make sure it's going to work every single batch, every single time, specific to the equipment and the different batch sizes. There's another job, you know. But if you're talking about, say, a cosmetic chemist role, we need to write it like that, because I don't know what equipment you're using. I don't know what batch you want, but I do know that if you use low shear mixing until it's homogenous and glossy, you can adapt that to your size. So you will see that in the examples, and please do look at that. That is important, especially if you've had a lot of laboratory training, because they want to see that you can go beyond. An employer wants to see when you're making a formula that you can go beyond that lab size and have that conversation with production. Because sometimes production managers are fully trained. Sometimes production managers have worked their way up from a very basic assistant who knows nothing about what they're doing. So therefore they're relying on your instructions. Does that make sense? So you do see that. I've got to say that our industry has definitely over the last few years been incredibly great in increasing its employment for young women. So go ladies, but show them that you can do it with example products. And I've got to say, I think that women in particular are more suited to our industry, because when you think about it, we've been playing with the stuff in our mum's cupboards from when we were eight. So, or younger sometimes. We know this sensory aspect, this particularness, that's probably not even a word, but the way that we're so specific about what we do and don't like, we understand that it is that competitive in the industry. Men, particularly young men that are really into their skincare, will also know what I'm talking about there. I know that a lot of my colleagues, when they've been older men, they've had to adapt. You know, they've had to adapt to understanding how it's become such a sensory and performance-based arena that we're working in. It can't be just the days of Sorbolene cream anymore, you know. And I entered the industry when, you know, that was still a popular thing. And, you know, thanks to the products, you can't tell. But it is great, because you are seeing these huge opportunities for young women today, because we do fundamentally appreciate some of these factors. So any men watching this, I'd encourage you to go and play with your wives' bathroom cupboards, girlfriends, sisters. Just get playing, because it's a lot of these things that is the difference between pharmacy and cosmetic that you need to understand. And I love, because it is so innovative and exciting and creative. It's such a creative scientific field.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's so much there. So, yeah, you know, even if you're a woman and you haven't been playing much, go play. And then, like I say, prepare samples, show a potential employer that you can do this and you've made something really, really nice, especially if you're going for, you know, a really good role. If you're moving it more at an entry level, the basic still shows them that you can put product together. But if you're going for, you know, maybe a slightly higher role or more into the technical aspects, show them that little bit extra effort.
Yeah. And I love how, like, not necessarily going through the production, but like, I love how the cosmetic industry itself, the messages are becoming so much more positive and inclusive and diverse. And like the sustainability, especially in Australia, is being pushed so much. So it's made me more interested as a consumer rather than being like, you know, normal beauty standards and stuff like that. Like, you can really get behind the message. I guess, like, one question I had personally, like, as someone, you have to keep watching the cosmetic industry. Do you find products are potentially becoming a bit too much oversaturated, the market itself?
Look, I think it's always had a tendency to do that, but then you'll see new trends come out. I have got a video. I'll have to send you the link on how to spot cosmetic trends. So one of the things we say to people too is, if you're trying to make a product to match a current trend, you're already 9 months too late. So you want to be, how do we watch and catch a trend in the early stages? So I've got this video where I talk about, you know, meet with your suppliers, and that could be you guys. You guys could be the next salespeople showing a chemist like me, hey, this is the next exciting thing. Attend trade shows and events when we can, you know, when we can get back out there, get to them. Even if you're a little shy, you'll often see me at the events, just come up and go, oh, hey, Belinda, I saw you on this recording. Look, we are a friendly bunch. And I've got to say, because the industry is becoming younger and younger, it's becoming more and more welcoming. When I first started, it was a bit of an old men in white coat type treatment. I even got, what would you know, you know, and it was a bit rough on women. I will tell you that. Not now. Which is why I'd encourage you to come to these events. You'll be amazed how many young people there are from diverse backgrounds. And one of the things, like I said before, that I really like about that is there is that innovation and creativity, and you guys are wanting more and more, well, I want it to suit me, you know, and that is fundamentally why different products have different sensory or performance, you know, and that's, you know, we're still attempting to cover a target market in some of our approaches, but it's still, but I want it to suit me. So yeah, watch that trends video. I give you a few tips. So yeah, it was like, go to trade shows, meet with your suppliers, join your local society of cosmetic chemists. We've actually got a conference in May 2022, which I'm part of the organising committee for, which hopefully we can have conferences again, which it's in Adelaide. If you are interested, it would be a great place to go. But we have them annually. Somewhere in Australia, we all get together. That's the Australian Society of Cosmetic Chemists. You can join as a student while you're still a student and save a lot of money. Like, your membership fees are really quite low. And then you can start attending your local chapter meetings. Again, a little limited right now, but it's good to just get and be a part of it when we can. So, you know, come and find me in Adelaide in May. You know, come and meet people. Don't be afraid. They do want to talk to you. If you are a chemist working for a company, they want to talk to you. They want to sell you their ingredients. If you are getting a job with an ingredient supplier, they want you to talk to the other chemists there. They want you to sell the ingredients. So there's a couple of ideas, but I'll send you that link as well. And that also helps you spot the trends. So we can use Google Trends to spot trends. Just remember, if it's trending and if a lot of companies are doing it now, you're already 9 months too late. You want to kind of catch it before it happens. And in that video, I also talk about how we look at fashion or actors, because they do set trends, and how you can kind of see what that will do. Also, just general attitudes towards things. Like, even with COVID, it really altered attitudes to a lot of things, and we had to kind of realign. So, and sustainability is a really, really strong future. So again, using sustainable materials, being at the forefront of creating sustainable materials, testing sustainable materials, they're all roles that we do.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much all we've got time for. Where could we and our viewers find you guys and find out more about you, please?
Sure. So you can go to personalcarescience.com.au. That's our website. Or find me on YouTube, Institute of Personal Care Science. We have over 300, we have nearly 400 videos on YouTube now. We have nearly 66,000 subscribers, so please subscribe. I want to get to 100,000. I want to get my little crystal thing. So we've got loads of topics there that you know, just type in the search bar. We've got a topic on it. If I don't have a topic, message us, say, hey, can you do this? That really is there to help people see innovation or solutions, or, yeah, just find out more. But definitely visit us, personalcarescience.com.au. We've got all of our course choices. Yeah. We had that careers video in Why Study with IPCS. You can meet the team on that page. Loads of information there for you. And of course, you can email us info@personalcarescience.com.au if you have any questions or want to know more about our courses.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks again for giving up some of your time today. I really appreciate it. And I'm definitely going to hit up that website and have a look at it later. Yeah.
Excellent. Thanks. And I'll see you at the conferences and maybe have meetings with some of you guys when you're trying to tell me about your materials.
To conclude the episode, we wish to acknowledge the people of the Kulin Nations on whose land we are gathered today. We pay our respects to the elders past, present and emerging. For those listening who may be based elsewhere, we pay our respects to the traditional owners of the land from wherever you may be listening from. We especially welcome any Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander people listening in today.